Good morning and welcome to Mountain Money. This is Larry Warren along with Doug Wells, and we are starting a new week under sunshine and looks gorgeous, although on our way to a 67 high today, we may get some scattered thunderstorms, about a 40% chance as this system moves out and then becomes sunny for the whole rest of the week, and summer returning with nice toasty temperatures. Still plenty of time to get out and ride a bike, Doug.
Well, and we got to learn to appreciate it yesterday after the cold, rainy weather.
So we have an interesting show today. I think you're really going to like our first guest, especially. He's almost a native son. He's an Idahoan, went to BYU, Idaho, then went off to the beach in Hawaii and came back with great ideas and has written the book Smart Cuts, How Hackers, Innovators, and Icons Accelerate Success. Our guest will be Shane Snow on the line from us, with us from New York City.
And speaking of innovators, our second guest is going to be Kimberly Hawk from the American Red Cross. Larry, you know I'm an Apple fanboy, and I often tell you there is an app for that. And if you are a blood donor, there is an app for you. They've got a new app to make it easier to remember to go in and donate blood.
So you can download your blood into your iPhone?
We're going to find out more. Maybe there's a little attachment they put on the phone.
I hope so.
And our last guest this morning is going to be Christian Amoroso. He's the CEO of Resort Web Feed. And if you have a website here in town and you'd like to include some of the resort information on your website, Christian's company makes it easy to do that. So stay tuned. Should be three good conversations. You're listening to Mountain Money on KPCW, and we'll be back in a moment. Please stay tuned.
Hello, this is Kristen Egan of Park City Realty Group, and I support KPCW. Every day I listen to and especially appreciate local news and weather. This has helped me live, play, and sell real estate in the Park City area for the past 14 years. I can be reached at 435-714-1067.
Hi, I'm Kelly from San Francisco Design, longtime supporter of KPCW. We provide a mix of European and mountain contemporary home furnishings for a unique Park City lifestyle. Our showrooms are in Park City and Salt Lake, and both offer complete design services. We're on the web at sanfrandesign.com.
And welcome back to Mountain Money, and let's start a conversation now with Shane Snow, author of Smart Cuts, How Hackers, Innovators, and Icons Accelerate Success. Welcome, Shane.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
You know, I said at the beginning, you're almost a native, hail from Idaho.
I do.
And we won't hold that against you. I'm sure you have many redeeming qualities as well. And went off to Hawaii. Say you didn't own a pair of shoes for 5 years, but now you're writing for all the top magazines, newspapers, and websites in the country. Wired, Fast Company, The Washington Post, The New Yorker. You're a LinkedIn influencer, etc., etc. And it sounds like the thesis of your book is forget about working your way to the top over a 30, 40-year career. Just cut past all that.
Well, that's one of the theses of the book. The idea that I wanted to explore is how do people and businesses that do incredible things in faster than expected amounts of time, how did they do it? What are the patterns? And so really I look at the kind of the common success advice that we hear in careers and in building businesses. And I look at what through academic research and through some great stories, what's real and what's not when it comes to not just successful people, but people that manage to be successful faster than everyone else.
Yeah, and I guess what's kind of annoying to people of a certain age is seeing Larry Page and Sergey Brin flying around in giant jets in their 20s and all the rest.
That's funny because I find that motivating.
You find that motivating?
I do, yeah, exactly.
Well, it is. So is there any common thread that runs through those who've gotten to the top without messing around in the middle too much?
There's so what I do is there's one overarching pattern, and it's this idea that psychologists call lateral thinking, which is that most of us, when we take on a problem, we attack it directly. We do a logical sort of linear progression. Lateral thinking is what computer hackers do, where they solve problems by reframing the problem or by coming in sideways. So instead of attacking the castle doors, you dig underneath the moat and come up through the middle. That's the way that computer hackers think. What you find is incredible people in history tend to think the same way and maybe in less nefarious ways. But whenever you see breakthroughs, you see that someone has broken the assumptions or the conventions of their time. And so that's really what accelerates the success.
Yeah, you use the term lateral thinking. I use the term win-win. You know, is there a way to think about this differently where everybody can win? And unfortunately, it's not always possible to do that, but oftentimes it is.
Sure.
And you have an analogy, a story, a fable, if you will, about riding on a Rhett Wainey stormy day. Let's talk about that for a second. Just share that story with our audience to just kind of lay the framework for what is lateral thinking.
So imagine that you're driving down a dark road and you're several miles away from town and it starts raining. And the rain starts coming down very hard. And so you slow your car down, you have your lights on, and you, in your lights as you slow down, you see on the side of the road a person and you happen to recognize them. That person, it turns out, lo and behold, is your best friend in the world. And they actually saved your life one time. So, like, oh my gosh, there's my friend, they're there in the rain. And you slow down. But next to them, you notice, is a little old lady who has a cane. And she clearly is not going to be able to walk back to town on her own. Well, next to her happens to be the man or woman of your dreams, and this is the once-in-a-lifetime opportunity that you have to meet them. So you look in your car, and you have one seat. So the question is, who do you pick? You have a very good reason to pick all of these people, but you have one seat. Who are you going to pick?
And let's pause there and let people think about that for a second. So you've got one seat. There's a reason to pick up all three of them. And how do you make this a win-win, which you call lateral thinking? So go ahead and share with us how maybe a lateral thinker would solve this problem.
So most of us, when we answer this question, we say, well, you know, the old lady, because she can't make it to town and that would be horrible, or no, my friend, because I owe them, or no, it's not selfish, that this is a one-time chance to meet this person in my dreams. Any of those answers, you can come to a logical conclusion. But the right answer is that, of course you should pick the old lady, but then you should give your car keys to your friend and you should stay out in the rain with the romantic interest and wait for the bus. And so I love that that answer and that solution, because you only get to the most elegant solution to that win-win that you're talking about by stepping back and reframing the question, asking if the question itself is valid. You know, I set up the question as, you have one seat, you can pick one person, who do you pick? But in reality, if you step outside the car, you have two seats now, but you can also help all three people. And so often in business or in life, we are given challenges where basically it's told us, you know, this is the path, this is the choice that you have, or these are the set of steps. But what you see when you look at the fastest risers or the biggest pioneers in almost any industry, you see that they tend to have this remarkable ability to step outside the car, reframe the question, rather than just sort of fight with everyone else on the front lines of sort of the conventional way of doing things.
And it's simplistic, but if you can incorporate that into your life time and time again, you probably can move the needle on your progression. And you talk about kind of the difference in thinking between people that become presidents versus folks that become senators and how those are two very different paths. And surprising to me, I hadn't really thought about it until you pointed it out in your book, but you're obviously right, the facts support it. The average age of a U.S. president when he starts office is quite a bit younger than the average age of U.S. senators when they start office. And why do you think that is? And tell us how that came to be.
Yeah, so I discovered that I was doing a data analysis about the fastest rising presidents, and I stumbled onto that age thing and was really curious. And so in exploring that, there's a lot of things that emerge. But there's a certain sort of path that is, well, so the point of that chapter is actually the great American success advice of climbing the ladder. You know, gain experience, put your head down, work hard, put in the extra hours, earn your dues, and when a spot opens up on the ladder, take it, right? You get promoted slowly, little by little. And there are a lot of people in Congress that in politics that that's exactly what they do. You know, they started the, in fact, the example I use in the book is Andrew Johnson. He started running for president when he was in 11th grade, and he won class president. And no, actually, that was Lyndon Johnson won class president. Both the Johnsons have a very similar story. But you start as a junior, you know, representative in the state, and then you go to the House of Representatives, and then you go, you become a senator, a junior senator, and then you become, you know, eventually a majority leader, and then eventually the vice president, and then the president dies, and you become the president, and you've spent 40 years in politics. That's the most linear path that you have, but the most expected path is, you know, state senator, congressperson, senator, president, or sometimes governor, president. What happens is when you look at the presidents that have been ranked the best by historians. There's the C-SPAN panel of historians a couple of years ago that ranked the best and worst presidents. The 10 best presidents actually are not only, some of them are actually much younger, but they have much less experience in Congress than the 10 worst presidents, and actually much less experience in Congress than the average congressperson. And in fact, the worst presidents tend to be folks like Andrew Johnson, who spent 3 years in politics and were terrible. And so basically what I found is that there's very little correlation between time spent with this sort of paying your dues idea, time spent climbing the ladder, and success or aptitude at the job. It doesn't mean that no time spent means you'll be a great president. There have been some awful presidents with very little experience. But on average, these presidents that are either very young or are very new to politics tend to do better. And it's because of a couple things. Because the job of a president and the job of any leader, really, and I think I would argue that any person who wants to be successful in any industry is to be flexible and adaptable. It's to see things from different angles. It's to take advice. It's to change your mind. And it's to be able to change your perspective. Because as a president, you're sitting down at a table and, you know, a room of people come in and they talk to you about nuclear proliferation. And then a room of people come in and they talk to you about the farm bill. And then people come in and talk to you about the economy. Your job is to listen, to absorb, and to make decisions very quickly. It's very hard to do that if you're a stubborn person or if you're a person that thinks traditionally or linearly. So if you earned your spot to be president by paying all the dues, by being there the longest, by sort of like this manly pursuit of climbing the ladder, you're more likely to say, no, I'm going to do it this way because that's how I do it or that's how it is, rather than be flexible. And some of the best presidents were the ones who made really hard decisions or made really hard compromises. And it turns out that they come from other industries that give them different perspectives. They climb through business and then move over to politics, or they climb through the military, which is the case in a lot of cases, military, yeah, and then over to president, or even, you know, entertainment or writers and philanthropists and, you know, police chiefs. Teddy Roosevelt was a police chief and kind of rose up and then moved over to politics. And so there's something about that that it not only refutes this idea that if you spend enough time, you will get your shot, that that's the best route, but it also gets at this idea that a variety of experience actually makes for better leaders and better thinkers, that you get lateral thinking by smashing disparate disciplines together and getting very good at different things and then moving over to become more successful in another area. That's where innovation is born.
Yeah, we're talking with Shane Snow. He's the author of Smart Cuts, How Hackers, Innovators, and Icons Accelerate Business. Well, let's talk about a couple of real-world examples, both in the business world, and you mentioned Jimmy Fallon. Maybe we'll get to him in a minute. But talk about one or two you've studied in the business world who have reached high places without sort of paying the dues, without working hard all their lives, but instead working smart and leapfrogging.
So one of my favorite examples is this guy named Elon Musk, who he's one of the co-founders of PayPal, and he's a billionaire, and he's the latest in a long line of billionaires who have tried to go to space. And he's a very smart guy, and a very hardworking guy. And that's actually one of the things that I discovered in my research and in the pursuit of this book is these people that do these incredible things, they do work very, very hard. They do more of the work with their heads than with sort of, rather than digging the ditch, they build the thing that digs the ditch for them, sort of idea. But Elon Musk is this very brilliant guy who he had a few billion dollars and he decided he wanted to go to space. And so he built this company called SpaceX. And what he did is, so the long line of billionaires before him had all either not managed to get a rocket off the ground or managed to blow up the rockets. And what happens is, even as a billionaire, you quickly go broke because it's an expensive business. NASA spends about $1 billion per space shuttle launch that they did before the shuttle was done. So what Musk did that was really interesting is he employs this principle that you see in a lot of innovative people that I call 10X thinking, where instead of saying, I want to decrease the cost of getting to space by 10% or by 50%, or I want to make it easier for us to get satellites in the air, he said, I want to die on Mars. He said, I want to make it so that if the human race gets wiped out on Earth, that the human race survives on another planet. So you say something like that, and people think you're crazy, first of all. They also start paying attention to you. And if your goal is to die on Mars and to make life multiplanetary, you by definition have to rethink everything about what it takes to build a rocket, because you are trying to get 10 times further than anyone else. And so what they did is they ended up, that became a forcing function for them to reinvent the rocket industry. The supply chain for how rockets get built, basically, you know, the people who make the rocket parts and sell them to you at extremely high cost, he decided they were going to all make it in one integrated factory. They're going to make them all themselves, which also sped up the process to getting rockets out. Also, another thing that he did that it seems obvious now, but that no one was doing, so whenever you see a rocket launch or a space shuttle, see that they have different sizes, so the different stages, right? Like the thing goes up and that piece falls off, and then the next piece goes flying and that piece falls off, the different stages of the rockets. And they're all different shapes and sizes, like they get progressively smaller. He decided that he was going to make all of his rockets the same cylindrical tube. So one cylindrical tube of one size, all of the stages are the same size, and then there's a nose cone. And so he built that rocket and got it to work. And then he said, well, if we want to carry more stuff into space, let's just pack 9 of those together. So instead of redesigning a whole new rocket, making new factories and new tools and much more costs, just sort of bundle 9 of these together like a pack of fireworks. And then stick a nose cone on that. And
like so, a kid in the backyard would do if he was shooting bottle rockets, right?
Exactly, exactly. What this did is it allowed them to start building these rockets very, very cheaply. And they, after a few failed launches, they were able to become the first private space company to get to orbit. In the book, I talk about the story of when they were down to the line and where every other billionaire had been, where he was out of money and had no more money for another rocket, and their last rocket failed. And at this sort of heartbreaking moment, they get bailed out. And I don't want to ruin the surprise of the chapter, but this miraculous thing happened. And it's because of the story that Musk tells. It was because of his 10X thinking and this huge mission that he managed to rally some support that no one else had been able to rally, that got them their next set of legs, that got them their next rocket.
You know, what's interesting about Musk as well, and the audience here in Park City might know him better as the founder of Tesla, the mm-hmm. electric car company, but in all of his companies, he had a point where, you know, his companies were months away from going out of business, and they weren't sure they were going to succeed. So these, you know, the 10X thinking is incredibly valuable, but also know that the journey can be scary.
It's very risky.
And having the courage to stay with it. And you know what? In Musk's case, he persevered. There was a lot of skill involved, but frankly, there was also some luck involved. Some of my classmates have invested in Musk and have worked with Musk. And there were times they thought they were going to lose their entire investment, which is quite substantial. So let's switch gears. One of my fans, when my kids were young, I used to love to read the book Peter Pan to them. And you've got an example of J.M. Barrie, the author of Peter Pan. He left his fortune to a children's hospital in London, which unfortunately was having, in certain procedures, was having a very high fatality rate, mortality rate in these young kids. It was a risky procedure. And they come up with a very clever way to help them think through some of the riskiest parts of this delicate surgery. Tell us who they turned to and how that group was able to help them.
So this is one of my favorite examples of lateral thinking in action in business. So it's the Great Ormond Street Hospital. They were having trouble with, they were doing these this pediatric surgery, mostly heart surgery. And they were having problems where they would operate on a small child, and then they had to transfer the child from the bed in the operating room to a gurney with all the equipment to keep the kid, you know, alive, and then transfer that gurney to the ICU, and then transfer them onto another bed. So there were kind of like two equipment switches so that the kid could recover. What they were finding is a huge percentage of these kids were having complications or even dying during that transfer process. They called it handovers. And part of it was just information gets lost. Part of it was it's really tricky. Part of it was there's so many people, so much stuff involved, and it has to be done really quickly. You know, you detach the ventilator for too long and the kid's going to die. So they're having all these problems, and it was really concerning. And the life and death thing, and at a children's hospital, everyone wants them this problem gone. Like, everyone has the highest motivation to solve this problem. But try as they could not figure out how to reduce these errors they were having. And in like 40% of the cases, there are both errors in communication and in equipment that that ended up being sort of double jeopardy, I guess. What they did is one day, a couple of the doctors said they were tired after a surgery, and so they sat down in the break room and the TV was on. And it was the Formula One, the race car driving circuit. And they're watching the racers drive, and then they saw a car pull into the pit stop, and the pit crew come and tear off all the tires, you know, refill the gas and throw on new tires, and the car is back out in 20 seconds or whatever it is. And the doctors looked at each other, and they said, this is exactly what we're trying to do, but for hospitals. And so they decided to take a trip down to Italy and meet with a Ferrari pit crew team, and learn how it is that they pack so many people into such a small space to do such a fast change and get these cars back on the road. And they learned a bunch of really interesting things that they then took back to the hospital. And they actually had some of these Ferrari folks come to the hospital with them to train. And there are all these problems that they had that they just didn't see because of the way that things were always done.
I love that story because particularly, you know, here the stakes are so high. And doctors, mm-hmm. frankly, are not known for thinking outside of their field of specialty for help, right? Doctors right. primarily like to consult with other doctors. So that was really, to me, energizing and encouraging to see that this complicated, important problem was solved by doctors being willing to broaden their horizon outside of the field of medicine looking for a solution. Shane, we've only got time for one last question. And I wanted to ask you, I looked up your bio on the company that you co-founded, Contently. And first off, let me just share with the audience that you're not only writing a book on this, but you've taken a bunch of smart cuts yourself. Your company's raised, I think, $13 million, including $9 million this past January from venture capitalists. So you're practicing what you preach. But my question to you is, in your bio, you said you have an unhealthy obsession with pizza, science, and surprises. And my question yes. my question to you is, tell us about your most recent favorite surprise.
Oh, well, it's actually a really sweet one. I turned 30 in August, and I was complaining to my assistant. It's a silly thing to complain about, but I was complaining to my assistant about how the good times are over. I'm turning 30, and I never liked my birthday because, you know, it's always a busy time and people forget birthdays. So I buy myself a birthday present. So a week after my birthday, one of my colleagues insisted that we meet for coffee at the end of the day, and I didn't think anything of it. So we go, we meet at the coffee shop rather than in the office to have our meeting, and then I come back and I open the elevator doors, and the whole office are all wearing T-shirts with my book cover on it, and there's balloons that say 30, and they threw me a surprise party. It was the only surprise party I've ever had in my life. It was a book launch / surprise party, and my publisher was there, my editor, and my agent, and so that was really sweet. It was actually like a little bit emotional for me that people, you know, I love surprises. I love little surprises. I love getting presents or things in the mail. But seeing so many people so happy for what I was up to and so supportive, it made me feel very loved. So that was, it also speaks to what a great company we've built. But like, that's kind of what was emotional about it. Like, wow, like we've hired these people that are so caring and awesome, and I don't deserve this. So it was pretty cool.
Nice, nice. Well, thanks, Shane Snow, for joining us. Shane Snow, the author of Smart Cuts, How Hackers, Innovators, and Icons Accelerate Business. It's out this month from HarperCollins, and thanks for joining us.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
Thanks, Shane. I enjoyed our conversation.
And we will be back in a minute. First, a word of weather. 67 is our expected high today. Possibly a 40% chance of scattered thunderstorms. I think that chance is waning as the day goes on. And so far, it looks really nice. Well, we will be back in just a minute to talk with Kimberly Houck from the Red Cross about using your iPhone or any other kind of smartphone to help the Red Cross after this.
This is Craig McCarthy with the Park City Chamber Bureau. Do you know that members of the Park City Chamber Bureau have access to a wide array of benefits that give them an edge in the local marketplace? We offer members-only insurance and discount programs, business-to-business networking opportunities, and much more. Becoming a member of the Park City Chamber Bureau is a great investment for your business. Information on joining is online at visitparkcity.com or call us at 649-6100. The Park City Chamber Bureau is a nonprofit organization.
This is Ryan Hoffman, branch manager at Mountain West Bank.
And Brooks Harbertson, commercial lender, sponsor of Mountain Money on KPCW.
We offer several products and services for individuals and businesses, including deposit and loan solutions.
Mountain West Bank, Kearns Boulevard, next to the theater, 649-3369.
Division of Glacier Bank, member FDIC, equal housing lender.
Welcome back to Mountain Money. Up next in just a moment or two is going to be Kimberly Houck of the Red Cross about a new app for folks that donate blood. But Larry, before we get there, real quick, we got a press release from State Farm. We all know this time of year, the migration of the larger animals, the deer, the elk, the moose that are in town has started. And State Farm is just reminding us to be careful. The second most likely month of the year that you're likely to hit a deer or a big animal is October. Surprising to me, the number one month is November. And it, as you know, as all of us know, it causes substantial damage to your car. So know that they're out there. They're migrating. Be careful, especially when you're driving at night. And I understand we've got our guest queued up right now.
Yeah, so before that, let me just say.
You got a story to share?
My car is a deer magnet, and I've tried everything. You can buy deer whistles, and you can put reflectors on your bumpers, and I thought deer whistles worked for a while, but I don't want friends of the animals to know just how many of those things I've hit in the last
more
few years.
More than your fair share?
Yeah.
Maybe that wasn't a press release to the station. Maybe that was an individual reminder that was sent directly to you from your insurance company.
I have dented up my car and dented up more deer than I care to think about. Anyway.
All right. Well, switching gears, I understand Kimberly Houck from the Red Cross, you're on the line. Welcome to Mound Money.
Thank you. Hello, Larry and Doug.
So first off, Larry is an Android fan, and I am an Apple fan. So you've got an app, but I've got to start with, is this available on both platforms or just one?
It absolutely is. So if you're an iPhone user, you're going to go to iTunes to download it like you would any other app. And if you're on Android, you're going to go to Google Play and download it.
Okay. So tell us, now that we know that it's available for all of us with smartphones, except does it work on Windows Phone?
I believe so.
Wow. Yeah. All right. So it's everywhere. So tell us what this app does.
So what this app is doing is it's a big push with the Red Cross to try to bring in the younger generations because we want to make them lifetime donors. There's always a need for blood in our area hospitals across the nation. And in order to have that blood on supply, we clearly need to have donors. So we're going to the smartphones. We're going to these apps that are very popular. We've created one where they can download it. It's very user-friendly. It can track their lifetime of donation, so they have the potential of seeing of how many lives they can potentially save as a result of all these lifetime donations that they're making, you know, a couple of times a year, however often they like to donate. It also has an ability for you to create life-saving teams with your family and friends, get more people involved in wanting to give back and to donate blood. You can also list your blood type on there. If should, heaven forbid, you get caught in an accident or something like that. Back in the day, everybody used to carry cards in their wallets. Well, these days, everybody's carrying phones. And when, you know, emergency workers go through your phone looking for somebody to contact, they can also see this app. They can see immediately what blood type you are. You also have a feature on this where you can take selfies while you're donating blood, because that's a big part of the younger generation is wanting to share that stuff on social media platforms. So it's got a bunch of different features that you can use in this app that makes it very attractive to the younger generation, but it also tracks how often you're donating and when you're eligible for it, and it will give you an alert if it's somewhere in your area. If there is a need for a particular blood type and you're that blood type, you're going to get an alert that says, hey, we're in need of O negative. You're O negative. Do you have any time in the next week to come in and donate?
I presume the whole idea is just to, A, be more efficient, and B, get more blood to the Red Cross.
Absolutely. Remind people there's a need for this. Not always top of mind with a lot of people. And you know, you can donate up to every 54 days, and people forget that they're eligible again. And, yeah, there's a need for more blood.
And what are the trends? Are you finding more people as a percent of our population are donating or less? What's happened over the last 10, 15 years?
Well, surprisingly, the younger generation is stepping up. So we see a lot of high school kids that are getting involved in donating blood. And a lot of that is just the networks that we're growing and the fact that we're taking it into high schools and teaching kids at a younger age about the ability to donate blood and to give back. And each donation has the potential to save up to 3 lives. I think a lot of people don't realize that we can take your whole blood donation, or we can spin out your platelets, cancer patients or burn victims. We can take your plasma. So all of these things that we can take from one donation that can potentially go to 3 different people is something that people don't realize. So the younger generation is stepping up. The trends are also that in the summertime we go really low, and we usually have to do an urgent plea for blood because people go on vacation, they're not around as much, and schools aren't in session. And again, these high school students are helping us out quite a bit with supplying this area with blood.
Yeah, and I presume this helps with your inventory. You see a certain blood type go low, and you can reach out, I suppose, text people. I know in the old days I used to get phone calls because I have an oddball blood type, and they'd call every once in a while and ask if I could come in. I presume now you can do text alerts, that sort of thing.
Right, text alerts, or it's going to be an alert on your app. And a lot of times when people get an app alert, it'll go into like the top part of their phone so they can see instantly what their emails are, what their alerts are on different apps and whatnot. So yeah, they'll get notified that you're in need. So for instance, if you're the universal blood type, which I am, O negative, we get a lot of alerts because everybody is in need of the universal blood type. And for those of you who might not understand what that means, it means that if emergency crews or paramedics roll up on an accident scene and they don't have time to test for your blood, everybody can take O negative. And so that is a very sought-after blood type, and it's only like 9-10% of the population that's O negative.
Now, is this the Red Cross nationally that developed this app, or is this an Intermountain area thing?
No, it's a national thing. We launched it in Las Vegas. It's across the nation. The Red Cross has a bunch of different apps. A lot of them are geared towards disaster relief type apps. This is the first time that we have launched a one-of-its-kind donation app for blood donors. So that people in their area can understand that in any disaster situation, but really just in everyday life, there's a need for blood.
And what percent of the population donates blood?
I don't have the figures on that, so I would have to look into that and get back to you.
I think it's actually really, really low.
It is low because people are fearful of needles, and what they need to understand is it's a very simple process. It's really not painful. I don't love needles, but I've been through it. It's not a big deal at all. They supply you with lots of treats and drinks and stuff so you don't get out of the chair feeling lightheaded or anything. They take a pint of your blood, which your body replenishes again in 24 hours. You have that completely replenished. And some people are under the belief that, you know, donating blood and causing your body to produce new blood is a healthy thing.
Kind of like an oil change, maybe.
Yeah, and a lot of people do look at it that way. But yeah, a lot of people are fearful of it. And the truth is, everybody needs to come in and understand that it's really not that big of a deal. Now, there are some restrictions. You have to be healthy. You have to be a certain weight. You have to weigh at least 110 pounds. You have to be 18 years old or older or have parental consent for 16 and 17-year-olds. And they do give you a health questionnaire. You have to sit down with somebody and go through a health questionnaire. The Red Cross is very careful with blood. It's thoroughly tested, so if anything's wrong, you're going to get notified of it. So that's another way also to just check your health, if you will, that if anything's going on with your blood, it's going to come through in the testing process and you will get a phone call.
Talk a little bit about the blood business itself. Is this blood being used locally? Are you part of a regional, national network? Could the various blood products that are donated end up anywhere in the country or world?
Well, the Red Cross is an international organization and national as well, and we stay here locally until we have a surplus. If we have a surplus of a certain type of blood here locally, it's going to be shipped somewhere else that sees a deficit here in the nation. And the reason for that is because there's a shelf life. Blood is only good for every 54 days. It has to be taken off the shelf and replaced. So if we have a surplus, say, if you will, of AB positive in Salt Lake City, and it's going to go to waste, and they have a deficit of AB positive in Louisiana, it's going to get put on a truck and shipped to Louisiana. So it's a nonprofit organization that works throughout the nation to make sure we completely supply the nation's hospitals that we have contracts with the blood that they need.
And let's talk about the organization for a minute, because first, a lot of people, like you say, have a fear of needles, but there's other ways that they can help out. So you guys are a nonprofit. You're based down in Salt Lake City. Quick plug for my daughter. The local high school here did not have an American Red Cross Club. You mentioned high school students. So she started one earlier this year at the beginning of the school season. And she's got quite a few members here locally, kind of as a service group. But if somebody wants to volunteer to help out at the Red Cross in Salt Lake City, what are some things they can do to help?
Well, that's really great that you bring that up, because we do rely heavily on volunteers. As a nonprofit organization, we have to have volunteers to run this as efficiently as possible and create such a low-cost product that we can get it to the hospitals in a reasonable amount of time and use as low funds as we can to do so to keep this nonprofit running. So volunteers are very crucial in the sense that they can come in, they can be drivers for us. So we can load up vans with blood, they can take them to the hospital versus us having to pay a driving service to do that and then just increasing the cost that we have here at the Red Cross. We ask for a lot of retired people to please help out in doing that across the nation, because it saves so much if somebody will just come in and donate an afternoon of their time and just be a driver for the Red Cross. That helps us out immensely. But we have opportunities to sit at the front desk or do all kinds of different things or talk with people that want to come in and donate blood or help supply the canteen of refreshments. There's always ways to help out and give back.
Okay. Well, great. Kimberly Hauck is our guest from the American Red Cross. Thank you for joining us this morning.
Thank you very much.
And we'll be back to continue Mountain Money with Christian Amoroso, the CEO of the Resort Web Feed, all about information about our great resort town. We'll continue with that after this.
American Roots on KPCW is proudly supported by Donna Van Buren of Greater Park City Properties, managing HOAs in Park City, Canyons, and Deer Valley for 30 years. Greater Park City Properties can be reached at hoa@greaterparkcityproperties.com.
A longtime supporter of KPCW, Jan's Mountain Outfitters sells and rents mountain bikes and road bikes. Our bike shop provides bike fitting, parts, tunes, and repair service. Jan's Fly Shop is stocked with fishing gear and offers guided fishing excursions and lessons, serving Park City for over 30 years. 649-4949 or jans.com.
Additional funding for programming on KPCW has been provided by Long Reimer Weiniger Bepler, Estate Planning Family Law, lrw-law.com. Park City Nursery, we know what grows, parkcitynursery.com. The Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and listeners like you.
Welcome back to Mound Money. Now we're going to switch gears from apps for donating blood to website feeds to help you get local information on your website. Our guest is Christian Amoroso. He's the CEO of Resort Web Feed and the website whattodo.com. Christian, welcome to Mound Money.
Thank you very much for having me on. Yes, I'm the CEO of a company called whattodo.info. And our website is whattodo.info. So we're that's a common misnomer, but we're not the .com.
I was going to say that's a great URL. Congrats for getting it. But it is whattodo.info. Okay, somebody else beats you to the punch. It probably costs at least $1 million to buy that. But tell us what whattodo.info and Resort Web Feed does.
Well, what I'm an entrepreneur. I grew up in ski towns. I've spent most of my life in and out of resorts, and what I learned in my travels was that almost every resort town believes it has a certain unique quality that a lot of the problems that we're faced with are similar. And so, as I started to come up in a resort community, I was the owner of a sporting goods store and the owner of a rafting company and a kayak school, and but I also was working for a lot of community chambers and doing marketing programs. So I would go out in the morning and sell advertising and resort marketing, and then I would go work in my store in the afternoon and be sold too. And what I really started to develop was a vision of what it would take to bring together the resorts to kind of get the most out of what we have. And that developed the concept of what to do and what we have now. What to do, a lot of people have seen our guidebooks and our resort maps, but we've also created a database of resort information. And for an advertiser, that's a great way for them to have one place to put their activity or event information and have it distributed. But the unique thing that we've been working on for the last 6 years is this concept of a resort feed. And what we've found is it's very difficult to collect information about all the activities and events that are going on in a resort community. And we make that very easy now with a WordPress feed so that that information can be distributed to people who are information providers. Those would be people that rent their properties, property management companies, information booths, a radio station like yours, if you wanted to have everything that was happening local and you knew how much work it was to produce that, you could just get a WordPress feed or a REST API from us, and that information would be ported directly to your website.
So how do you know all this information? This sounds kind of daunting if you're in however many 20-some, 30, 40, however many markets you're in. How do you go about gathering all the information?
Well, what we've done is we kind of took the long approach and to say that our company has kind of done things backwards. We've done the most expensive and the hardest things first. And what that entails is we have products in areas where we have guidebooks or walking maps and the websites. And so we look at the website as a three-part. For the destination resort, you have visitors that are coming that need information. You have the information providers, which would typically be a realtor or a property management company that wants to provide that information. And then you have the activity provider that would like to attract these guests. And when we look at this program, you see that somebody that's thinking about going on a vacation might end up searching 13, 14 different websites or going to a large central provider like a resort or a chamber that might not have the whole picture. And how we do it is we offer advertising to the activity provider, information to the information provider, and a number of different portals for the visitor. So everybody kind of knows what a social network is, but we've created a commercial network which basically covers your bases so that you know you can get your message out for a resort community.
Yeah, and folks might be interested to know, and many folks are aware of this, but having local content on a local website really helps your ranking. So if a tourist comes into town and types in Park City, what to do outdoors, if you've got that local content, you're kayak shop, your fly fishing shop is going to show up higher. What I like about your strategy is not only are you consolidating what there is to do in a town like ours and others, but you're not holding that proprietary. You're not just putting it on your website, but you're offering it as a feed to everybody else. Why did you decide to go that route?
Well, I'll tell you, it was really one of those pivotal moments for me. I was working as a publisher, and I was producing a number of pieces for local chambers and resort communities. And all of the communities, like if you look at the Vail Valley where we started, you might think of it as one place, but you know, we have seven different town entities, multiple chambers, and almost every chamber, or there was a time when the people that had the information kind of dominated the landscape. And so, you know, my passion is about bringing up the entrepreneur, the little guy, and looking at, in the age of the mega resorts, how does that person get a fair stake? And so when people would ask me, they would say, we need a program where we can, you know, make money, you know, produce, support our organization, and we also want to advertise all of our people that are part of our organization. But they would say, but we want it just for us. And I kept coming back to them saying, we must have some kind of way that we can work together as a resort. You might have 700, 800 realtors in a resort that are all acting as concierge to your area, but no one is reaching out and giving them information that they can use to help promote their own area and benefit from the work that they do. So I took a step back and started seeing the community as kind of a holistic organization that was non-aligned, so not aligned with any specific chamber and not aligned with any specific mega resort, and saying that I think private industry can solve this problem.
Do you see in your work in resort towns a lot of commonalities in their economies, or is every resort town not a cookie cutter, but pretty unique, requiring or having different economic drivers and models?
You know, I think that there are certain things that are unique to each resort, but surprisingly, beyond what even most town councilmen or some other people would think, there's an undercurrent of commonality between us. And usually, I mean, I think that resort communities, large resort communities, would be excellent places to study resort marketing, would be excellent places to put together schools or to look at resort marketing. And usually what happens is you have a couple of significant players which kind of dominate that market and are so competitive that they don't really harness what the community has to offer. But I see communal threads running between all of us. When you're in a destination resort, you're talking about you're having off-season economies, trying to get qualified employees, trying to keep long-term employees. In fact, you know, as far as the abilities to have options for, you know, families to grow and develop, there's so many things that run through the resort communities that that are common, that are not problems that people typically try to solve. And that's what we do, is we're trying to give solution to the small business owner, solution to the property management company, and provide a new portal for the guests, and really feel like this is kind of a different territory than has really been developed for destination resorts.
Yeah, this question is a little off the topic of your business, but you're a resort businessman who pays attention, so surely you know that, like you said, in every resort town there are a few dominant players. The number of dominant players have been reduced by one, and one has doubled in size in our town, which is Vail. Do you have any thoughts about what that acquisition of Park City Mountain Resort and the Canyons by one player like Vail, how that changes an economy?
Well, I do. I mean, and again, I have customers with Vail Resorts, and I think that Vail Resorts is a very well run organization. But you know, where I've lived, you know, in the shadow of Vail Resorts my whole life, and what concerns me the most when I look at this is that, well, I shouldn't say concerns, a little different word, but when a resort comes in and purchases, they may have, any kind of specific resort might have some interesting ideas. They may be purchasing something that's not in their product line that they want to acquire, or it might be something that matches very closely with their product line that they know that by running that better, they're going to be able to increase some economy of scale. And when that organization comes in, and you know, one thing that I learned almost 20 years ago is that sometimes they'll look at a couple of things. One is if you're looking at somebody coming in saying a resort is getting maybe 13 cents of every dollar that's spent there, they can make acquisitions in the community. And that can be a very good thing, but they can start buying certain activity providers, certain hotels. And if you're aligned with that resort, that could be a very good thing for you. If you're not aligned with it, that could be that could cause you to struggle. And the second thing, which is not necessarily true because resorts do look at high-end products and discount products, is that a resort might be interested in doubling the prices on something. Like we've had some core redevelopment areas where prices have gone. You know, if you're making, when you're trying to get more of a dollar, you have a lot of work to do when you get to the top end of that. But if you start to increase the product services and focus on higher end, what we're concerned about is we want resorts to be lively and productive, and we want the next paddleboard person to come along. We want the next outdoors person. I want people taking people out into the environment and showing them what these resorts are capable of. And that's my passion, is for the small business entrepreneur and to give humans a connection with these resort activities that we love. And that is kind of my way of seeing that the more people can experience the outdoors and the things that these communities have to offer, the more that they might actually care about them. So, big resorts can change the environment. And, you know, for us with the resort feed, if you were looking at a small property management company that wasn't owned by a resort, they might be asking themselves, how is our web presence going to be as good, if not better, than this resort? And our answer is to give them an inexpensive way to port the area information onto their website so that their web product, at least, is on par with the big guys, which a lot of people have been so frustrated with that they just have abandoned these ideas of having a good web product.
Well, it sounds like the timing for your product is good. You know, one of the things I love about living in a resort town is the entire town has a common vision, right? We might compete with one another in certain ways, but we all share a common vision, which is we all benefit if we make this a destination that more and more tourists want to come to. And I think your point about aligning yourself with the resorts and making sure that you're complementing what the resorts are doing is helpful and getting noticed, which is what your product does for the folks that are coming to visit. We thank you for joining us. Our guest has been Christian Amoroso. He's the CEO of Resort Webfeed and also the website whattodo.info. Christian, thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
And we'll be back to wrap up Mountain Money after this. And welcome back to Mountain Money. Just a couple of minutes left. Doug, I want to thank our guest, Shane Snow, almost local now, who's in New York City with his book, Smart Cuts, just out, How Hackers, Innovators, and Icons Accelerate Success. Also, Kimberly Houck. You can go to any of the mobile app stores and pick up the Red Cross app, and Christian Amoroso. And that website is whattodo.info. And I want to thank our great sponsors of this show, Park City Realty Group, Mountain West Bank, Park City Chamber, Berkshire Hathaway Home Services Utah Properties, San Francisco Design, and Jones Waldo, Holbrook, and McDonough. Couldn't do it without your support. Thanks a lot.
Great. And I guess just one last tidbit, another news release that we got is Utah's unemployment continues to go down. The state's doing a great job. Our unemployment's 3.6%. Nationwide, it's a little over 6%, 6.1%. So good job, Utah, and we're all fortunate to live in a state where the political leaders have made decisions to help us stay fully employed.
You know, you drive around the valley and you see construction cranes again.
It's which busy.
Is sure a good sign. This is a booming economy, one of the top ones in the country at the moment. Okay, so next week we will talk about The Reciprocity Advantage, which is a new book which is out, and also talk with a couple of new local businesses. This Green Earth in this spot tomorrow. This is KPCW Park City.